With a casual ease, Raleigh tossed a light brown sport coat over his shoulder and reached for the door.
"Try my name. I've been a civilian now for 5 years."
"Okay, Raleigh," I said with a faint smile. "You ever get to see a dead body while you were in Northern?"
Chapter 13. The joke in Homicide about the morgue was that in spite of the lousy climate, the place was good for business. There's nothing like the sharp smell of formaldehyde or the depressing sheen of hospital-tiled halls to make the drudgery of chasing down dead leads seem like inspired work. But, as they say, that's where the bodies are. That, and I got to see my buddy Claire. There wasn't much to say about Claire Washburn, except that she was brilliant, totally accomplished, and absolutely my best friend in the world. For 6 years, she had been the city's chief medical examiner, which everyone in Homicide knew was as under-deserving a title as there was, since she virtually ran the office for Anthony Righetti. Righetti is her overbearing, power-thumping, credit-stealing boss. But Claire rarely complains. In our book, Claire is the office of the coroner. But maybe the idea of a female ME still didn't cut it, even in San Francisco. Female and black. When Raleigh and I arrived, we were ushered into Claire's office. She was wearing her white doctor's coat with the nickname Butterfly embroidered on the upper left pocket. The first thing you noticed about Claire was that she was carrying 50 pounds she didn't need.
"I'm in shape," she always joked. "Round's a shape."
The second was her bright, confident demeanor. You knew she couldn't give a damn. She had the body of a Brahmin, the mind of a hawk, and the gentle soul of a butterfly. As we walked in, she gave me a weary but satisfied smile, as if she'd been up working most of the night. I introduced Raleigh, and Claire flashed me an impressed wag of the eyes. Whatever I had accumulated over the years in street smarts, she threw off in natural wisdom. How she balanced the demands of her job and placating her credit-seeking boss with raising 2 teenage kids was a marvel. And her marriage to Edmund, who played bass drum for the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, gave me faith that the institution still had some hope.
"I've been expecting you," she said as we hugged. "I called you last night from here. Didn't you get the message?"
With her comforting arms around me, a flood of emotion welled up. I wanted to tell her everything. If it weren't for Raleigh, I think I would have spilled it all. Orenthaler, Negley's, right there. "I was beat," I answered. "And beat up. Long, tough day."
"Don't tell me," Raleigh chuckled, "you guys have met." "Standard autopsy preparation," Claire grinned as we pulled apart. "Don't they teach you that stuff down at City Hall?"
He playfully spread his arms.
"Uh-uh," said Claire, squeezing my shoulder. "This you gotta earn." "Anyway," she regained a tone of seriousness, "I finished the preliminaries just this morning. You want to see the bodies?"
I nodded yes.
"Just be prepared. These two don't make much of an advertisement for Modern Bride."
She led us through a series of closed compression doors toward the vault, the large refrigerated room where the bodies were stored. I walked ahead with Claire, who pulled me close and whispered,
"Let me guess, you gave Jacoby a kiss on the nose, and all of a sudden there was this charming prince."
"He works for the mayor, Claire," I smiled back. "They sent him here to make sure I don't faint at the first sign of blood."
"In that case," she replied, pushing the heavy door to the vault open, "you better hold on to that man tight."
Chapter 14. I had been having very close encounters with dead bodies for 6 years now, but what I saw sent a shiver of revulsion racing through me. The mutilated bodies of the bride and groom were lying side by side. They were on gurneys, their faces frozen in the horrifying moment of their deaths. David and Melanie Brandt. In their stark, ghostly expressions was the strongest statement I have ever seen that life may not be governed by anything fair or clement. I looked on the face of Melanie. Yesterday, in her wedding dress, she had seemed somehow tragic and tranquil. Today, in her slashed, naked starkness, her body was snarled in a freeze frame of grotesque horror. Everything I had buried deep yesterday rushed to the surface again. 6 years in Homicide, and I had never turned away,
but I turned away now. I felt Claire's hand bolstering my arm and leaned into her. To my surprise, it turned out to be Raleigh. I righted myself with a mixture of anger and embarrassment. "Thanks," I exhaled. "I'm okay."
"I've been doing this job 8 years," Claire said, "and this one, I wanted to turn away myself."
She picked up a folder from an examining table across from David Brandt. She pointed to the raw, gaping knife wound on the left side of his chest.
"He was stabbed once in the right ventricle. You can see here the blade pierced the juncture between the fourth rib and the sternum on the way in. Ruptured the AV node, which provides the heart's electrical powering. Technically, he arrested."
"He died of a heart attack?" Raleigh asked. She pulled a pair of tight surgical gloves over her hands and red lacquered nails.
"Electromechanical dissociation. Just a fancy way of describing what happens when you get stabbed in the heart."
"What about the weapon?" I spoke up.
"At this point, all I know is that it was a standard straight-edged blade. No distinguishing marks or entry pattern. One thing I can tell you is that the killer was medium height, anywhere from 5'7 to 5'10, and right-handed, based on the angle of impact. You can see here the path of the incision is angled slightly upward. Here," she said, poking around the wound. "The groom was 6 feet. On his wife, who was 5'5, the angle of the first incision was slanted in a downward path."
I checked the groom's hands and arms for abrasions. "Any signs of a struggle?"
"Couldn't. The poor man was scared right out of his mind."
I nodded as my eyes fell on the groom's face. Claire shook her head.
"That's not exactly what I meant. Charlie Clapper's boys scraped up samples of a fluid from the groom's shoes and the hardwood floor in the foyer where he was found."
She held up a small vial containing droplets of a cloudy liquid. Raleigh and I stared at it, uncomprehending.
"Urine," explained Claire. "The poor man apparently went in his pants. Must have been a gusher."
She pulled a white sheet over David Brandt's face and shook her head.
"I figure that's one secret we can keep to ourselves." "Unfortunately," she said with a sigh, "things didn't happen nearly as swiftly for the bride."
She led us over to the bride's gurney.
"Maybe she surprised him. There are marks on her hands and wrists that indicate a struggle. Here," she pointed to a reddened abrasion on her neck. "I tried to lift some tissue from under her nails, but we'll see what comes back. Anyway, the first wound was in the upper abdomen and tore through the lungs. With time, given the loss of blood, she might have died from that."
She pointed to a second and third ugly incision under the left breast in a similar location to the groom's.
"Her pericardium was filled with so much blood you could have wrung it out like a wet dish rag."
"You're getting technical again," I said.
"The tissue-like membrane around the heart. Blood collects in this space and compresses the muscle so that the heart can no longer fill with blood from the main return. Ultimately, it ends up strangling itself."
The image of the bride's heart choking on her own blood chilled me. "It's almost as if he wanted to duplicate the wounds," I said, studying the knife entry points.
"I thought of that," said Claire. "Straight line to the heart."
Raleigh furrowed his brow.
"So the killer could be professional?"
Claire shrugged.
"By the technical pattern of the wounds, perhaps, but I don't think so."
There was a hesitancy in her voice. I looked up and fixed on her grim eyes. "So what I need to know is, was she sexually molested?"
She swallowed. "There are clear signs of some sort of post-mortem penetration. The vaginal mucosa was severely extended, and I found small lacerations around the introitus."
My body stiffened in rage.
"She was raped!" "If she was raped," Claire replied, "it was a very bad deal. The vaginal cavity was as wide as I've ever seen it. Honestly, I don't think we're talking penile entry at all."
"Blunt instrument," Raleigh said.
"Certainly wide enough. But there are abrasions along the vaginal walls consistent with some kind of ring."
Claire took in a breath.
"Personally, I'd go with a fist.
The angry, shocking nature of Melanie Brandt's death shivered me again. She had been mutilated, defiled. A fist. It had a blunt, savage finality to it. Her assailant wasn't just trying to act out his nightmare, but wanted to shame her as well. Why?
If you can handle one more thing, follow me, Claire said.
She led us out through a swinging door into an adjoining lab. On an apron of white sterile paper lay the blood-smeared tuxedo jacket we had found next to the groom. Claire picked it up by the collar.
Clapper loaned it to me. Of course, the obvious thing was to confirm whose blood was actually on it.
The left front panel was slashed through with the fatal incision and sprayed with dark splotches of blood.
Where this starts to get really interesting, said Claire, is that it wasn't just David Brandt's blood that I found on the front of the jacket.
Raleigh and I gaped in surprise.
The killers? He said, wide-eyed.
She shook her head.
No. The brides.
I made a fast recollection of the crime scene. The groom had been killed at the door, his wife 30 feet away in the master bedroom. How could the bride's blood get on his jacket? I said, confused.
I struggled with the same thing, so I went back and lined up the jacket against the groom's torso. The slash mark didn't quite match up with his wound. Look, the groom's wound was here, 4th rib. The slash marks on the jacket are 3 inches higher. Checking further, the damn jacket isn't even the same brand as the pants. This is Joseph Aboud.
Claire winked, seeing the gears of my brain shift into place. The jacket wasn't the groom's. It belonged to the man who had killed him. Claire rounded her eyes.
Ain't no professional I know would leave that behind.
He could have been just trying to utilize the wedding as a cover, Raleigh replied.
An even more chilling possibility had already struck me. He could have been a guest. Chapter 15. At the offices of the San Francisco Chronicle, Cindy Thomas's frantic brain was just barely staying ahead of her fingers. The afternoon deadline was barely an hour away. From a bellhop at the Hyatt, she had been able to obtain the names of 2 guests who had attended the Brandt wedding and who were still at the hotel. After running down there again last night, she had been able to put together a heart-wrenching, tragic picture, complete with vows, toasts, and a romantic last dance, of the bride and groom's final agonizing moments. All the other reporters were still piecing together the sparse details released by the police. She was ahead so far. She was winning, and it felt great. She was also certain this was the best writing she'd done since arriving at the Chronicle, and maybe since she'd been an undergraduate at Michigan. At the paper, Cindy's coup at the Hyatt had turned her into an instant celebrity. People she scarcely knew were suddenly stopping and congratulating her. Even the publisher, whom she rarely saw on the Metro floor, came down to find out who she was. Metro was covering some demonstration in Mill Valley about a construction rerouting that had built up traffic near a school zone. She was writing page 1. As she typed, she noticed Sidney Glass, her city editor, coming up to her desk. Glass was known at the newspaper as El Cid. He parked himself across from her with a stiff sigh.
"We need to talk."
Her fingers slowly settled to a halt as she looked up.
"I've got 2 very pissed-off senior crime reporters itching to get into this. Susie's at City Hall awaiting a statement by the police chief and the mayor. Stone's put together profiles on both families. They have 20 years and 2 Pulitzers between them. And it is their beat."
Cindy felt her heart nearly come to a stop. "What did you tell them?" she asked. In El Cid's hardened eyes, she could see the greedy first-team crime staff, senior reporters with their own researchers, trying to hack their way in and carve this story up. Her story.
"Show me what you've got,"
the city editor finally said. He came around, peered over her shoulder, read a few lines off the computer screen.
"A lot of it's okay. You probably know that anguished belongs over here," he said, pointing at the screen. "It modifies bride's father. Nothing pisses Ida Morris off like misplaced modifiers and inversions."
Cindy could feel herself blushing. "I know, I know. I'm trying to get this in. Deadline's at—"
"I know when deadline is," the editor glowered. "But down here, if you can get it in, you can get it in right."
He studied Cindy for what seemed an interminable duration, a deep, assessing stare that kept her on edge.
"Especially if you intend to stay on this thing."
Glass's generally implacable face twitched, and he almost smiled at her.
"I told them it was yours, Thomas."
Cindy repressed an urge to hug the cranky, domineering editor right on the bullpen floor. "You want me at City Hall?" she asked.
"The real story's in that hotel suite. Go back to the Hyatt."
El Cid began to walk away with his hands, as always, thrust into his trouser pockets. But a moment later he turned back.
"Course, if you intend to stay on this story, you'd better find a police source on the inside. And quick."
Chapter 16. After leaving the morgue, Raleigh and I walked back to the office, mostly in silence. Lots of details about the murders were bothering me. Why would the killer take away the victim's jacket? Why leave the champagne bottle? It made no sense. "We've got a sex crime now. Bad one." I finally turned to him on the asphalt walkway leading to the hall. "I want to run the autopsy results through Milt Fanning and the FBI computers. We also need to meet with the bride's parents. We'll need a history on anyone she may have been involved with before David, and a list of everyone at that wedding."
"Why don't we wait for some confirmation on that one," my new partner said, "before we go all out on that angle?"
I stopped walking and stared at him. "You want to see if anybody checked in for a bloody jacket with the lost and found? I don't understand. What's your concern?"
"My concern," Raleigh said, "is that I don't want the department intruding on the grief of the families with a lot of hypotheticals until we have more to go on. We may or may not have the killer's jacket. He may or may not have been a guest." "Who do you think it belonged to, the rabbi?"
He flashed me a quick smile. "It could have been left there to set us off." His tone seemed suddenly different. "You're backing off?" I asked him.
"I'm not backing off," he said, "until we have something firm. Every old boyfriend of the bride, or casualty of some corporate downsizing Gerald Brandt had a hand in, could be rolled out as a possible suspect. I'd rather the spotlight wasn't aimed back at them unless we have something firm to go on."
Here it was. The spiel. Packaging containment. Brandt and Chancellor Weil, the bride's father, were VIPs. "Find us the bad guys, Lindsay. Just don't put the department at any risk along the way." I chuffed back. I thought the possibility that the killer could have been at that wedding was what we had to go on.
"All I'm suggesting, Lindsay, is let's get some confirmation before we begin ripping into the sex life of the best man."
I nodded, all the while fixing in on his eyes. "In the meantime, Chris, we'll just follow up on our other really strong leads." We stood there in edgy silence. "All right. Why do you think the killer changed jackets with the groom?" I asked him. He leaned back against the edge of a cement retaining wall.
"My guess is that he was wearing it when he killed them. It was covered with blood. He had to get out undetected. The groom's jacket was lying around, so he just switched."
"So you figure he went to all that trouble making the slash mark and all, thinking no one would notice? Different size, different maker, that it would just slip by?" "Raleigh, why did he leave it behind? Why wouldn't he stuff the bloody jacket into a bag, or roll it under his new jacket?"
"Okay," Raleigh conceded. "I don't know. Your guess is?"
I didn't know why he had left it behind, but a chilling possibility was beginning to form in my mind. "Possibility one," I answered. "He panicked. Maybe the phone rang or someone knocked at the door."
"On their wedding night?"
"You're starting to sound like my ex-partner."
I started toward the hall and he caught up. He held the glass doors open for me.
As I walked through, he took my arm.
"And number two?"
I stood there looking squarely into his eyes, trying to assess just how far I could go with him. "What's your real expertise here, anyway?" I asked. He smiled, his look confident and secure.
"I used to be married."
I didn't reply. Possibility two. A fear was building inside me. The killer was signing his murders. He was toying with us, purposely leaving clues.
One-time crime-of-passion killers didn't leave clues like the jacket. Professionals didn't either. Serials left clues.
Chapter 17. The window that Philip Campbell was staring out had a startling view of the bay, but he didn't really notice the sights. He was lost in his thoughts. It's finally started. Everything is in play, he was thinking. The city on the bay will never be the same, will it? I will never be the same. This was complicated, not what it seemed to be, but beautiful in its own way. He had closed his office door, as he always did when he was absorbed in research. Lately, he had stopped catching lunch with his co-workers. They bored him. Their lives were filled with petty concerns. The stock market, the Giants and the 49ers, where they were headed on vacation. They had such shallow, simple, middle-class dreams. His were soaring. He was like the moguls thinking up their new things over in Silicon Valley. Anyway, that was all in the past. Now he had a secret. The biggest secret in the world. He pushed his business papers to the corner of his desk. This is the old world, he thought. The old me. The bore. The worker bee. He unlocked the top left drawer of his desk. Behind the usual personal clutter was a small gray lockbox. It was barely large enough to hold a packet of 3x5-inch cards. This is my world now. He thought back to the Hyatt, the bride's beautiful porcelain face, the blossoms of blood on her chest. He still couldn't believe what had taken place. The sharp crack of the knife ripping through cartilage, the gasp of her last breath. And his, of course. What were their names? Oh, Jesus Christ, he'd forgotten. No, he hadn't. The Brants. They were all over the newspapers and the TV news. With a key from his chain, he opened the small box. What spilled out into the room was the intoxicating spell of his dreams. A stack of index cards, neat and orderly, alphabetically arranged. One by one, he skimmed through them. New names. King, Merced, Passano, Peterson. All the brides and grooms. Chapter 18. Several urgent messages were on my desk when I got back from the morgue. Good, urgent was appropriate. Charlie Clapper from CSU, preliminary report in, some reporters from the AP, local television stations, even the woman from the Chronicle who had left me her card. I picked at a grilled chicken and pear salad I had brought up as I dialed Clapper back. Only good news, I joked as his voice came on the phone. In that case, I can give you a 900 number. For $2 a minute, they'll tell you anything you want to hear.
I could hear it in the tone of his voice. You got nothing?
Tons of partials, Lindsay, the CSU chief replied, meaning inconclusive prints his team had lifted from the room. The brides, the grooms, the assistant managers, housekeepings.
You dusted the bodies? I pressed. The killer had pulled Melanie Brandt up off the floor. And the box of champagne?
Of course. Nothing. Somebody was careful.
What about off the floor? Fibers, shoe prints.
Besides the pee? Clapper laughed. You think I'm holding out on you? You're cute, Lindsay, but I get off on bagging killers more. Meanwhile, I've got someone running that tux jacket under the microscope. I'll let you know. Roger Wilco.
Thanks, Charlie, I muttered disappointedly.
As I flipped further through my stack of messages, Cindy Thomas's name came to the top. Normally, I wasn't in the habit of phoning back reporters in the middle of an ongoing investigation, but this one had been smart and cool making her way up to the crime scene, yet kind in backing off when she had me cornered in the bathroom. I found her at her desk.
"Thanks for calling me back, Inspector," she said in an appreciative tone.
"I owed you, I guess. Thanks for cutting me some slack at the hotel."
"Happens to us all. But I have to ask, do you always react so personally at a crime scene? You're a homicide detective, right?"
I didn't have the time or heart to get into a battle of wits, so I used Jacoby's line. "It was a wedding. I always cry at them. What can I do for you, Miss Thomas?"
"Cindy, I'm going to do you a favor. When I reach 5, maybe you'll do one for me."
We have a homicide, a very bad one. We're not going to play Let's Make a Deal. And if we meet again, you'll find I'm not my cheeriest when I feel indebted.
I guess what I was hoping for, she said, was to hear your spin on the bride and groom.
Doesn't Tom Stone cover homicide for the Chronicle? I asked. I heard her take in a breath.
I won't lie to you. I normally handle local interest out of Metro.
Well, you got yourself a real story now. Marriage made in heaven ends up in hell. You're quick out of the gate.
Truth is, Inspector, her voice grew softer, I'd never seen anything like that before. Seeing David Brandt lying there on his wedding night, I know what you must think, but it's not just about the story. I'd like to help any way I can.
I appreciate that, but since we've got all these eager people with badges walking around here, we ought to give them a shot. Anyway, you should know that you sneaking your way up to the 30th floor didn't exactly get me invited to the commissioner's for brunch. I had tactical responsibility at the crime scene.
I never thought I'd actually make it through.
So we've established we don't know who owes whom here. But since it's my dime...
The reporter's voice went back to a peremptory tone. I called to get your reaction to a story we're going to break later today. You know the groom's father runs a buyout firm. Our business editor pulled off Bloomberg that they backed out of a proposed agreement at the last minute with the third largest Russian automaker, Kolya Novgorod. Brandt was providing up to $200 million for a significant stake. Kolya's one of those Russian conglomerates taken over by a new branch of black market capitalists. Without the cash, I'm told it's virtually bankrupt. My source tells me the mood got very fractious.
I laughed. Fractious, Miss Thomas? I might be getting a little fractious myself.
Apparently some of the Russians were left hanging with their Uncle Vanya's out.
I laughed again. Conspiracy to commit murder is a federal crime, I told her. If there's something to it, you should make the call to justice.
I just thought I'd let you know. In the meantime, you want to throw me a comment on any other possibilities you're looking into?
Sure. I'd feel safe in saying that they're ongoing.
Thanks, she sighed. Have you narrowed in on any suspects yet?
This is what they tell you to ask at the Chronicle. You know I can't divulge that.
Off the record, no attribution, as a friend.
As I listened, I remembered when I was a recruit trying to elbow my way in. How the police world had been barred, closed off, until someone had opened up the tiniest crack to let me crawl through. Like I said, Miss Thomas, my tone starting to soften, no promises.
Cindy, the reporter said, at least call me Cindy. For the next time you get cornered in the bathroom with your guard down.
Okay, Cindy. I'll be sure to keep you in mind.
Chapter 19. I didn't want to go home, and I knew I couldn't stay at the hall any longer. I grabbed my bag, rushed down to the underground garage, and started up my trusty dusty Bronco without a clear sense of where I was headed. I just drove. Fourth, Third, onto Mission, past the Moscone Center, cafes, closed-up shops, all the way down toward the Embarcadero. I wrapped around Battery, heading away from the bay. I had nowhere to go, but my hands seemed to act on their own, leading me somewhere. Flashes of the murdered bride and groom flickered in my head. Echoes of Orenthaler. I'd finally called Dr. Medved, the hematologist, for an appointment. I was approaching Sutter, and I turned. Suddenly, I knew where I was heading. I pulled into Union Square. Without even knowing it, I found myself in front of the brightly lit entrance of the Hyatt. I badged the manager and took the elevator up to the 30th floor. A single uniformed guard sat in front of the Mandarin suite. I recognized him, David Hale, out of Central. He stood up as he saw me approach.
Nowhere to go, Inspector?
A crisscrossing barrier of yellow tape blocked the entrance to the Mandarin suite. Hale gave me the key. I peeled off a band or two of tape and slipped under the rest. I turned the lock, and I was inside. If you've never wandered alone at the sight of a freshly committed murder, you don't really know the feeling of restless unease. I felt the dark ghosts of David and Melanie Brandt were still in the room. I was sure I had missed something. I was also sure it was here.
What?
The suite was pretty much as I had left it. The oriental carpet in the living room had gone to Clapper's lab, but body positions and blood sites were clearly marked out with blue chalk. I looked at the spot where David Brandt had died. In my mind, I retraced what had likely taken place. They are toasting each other. I knew that from the half-filled champagne glasses on a table near the terrace. Maybe he just gave her the earrings. The open box was on the master bathroom counter. There's a knock. David Brandt goes to answer. It was as if secrets were buzzing in the thick air, alive with whispers. The killer comes in, carrying the champagne box. Maybe David knows him. Maybe he just left him an hour before at the reception. The knife comes out. Only one thrust. The groom is pinned against the door, apoplectic. It happens so fast that he cannot scream.
"Poor man went in his pants," Claire had said.
The bride doesn't scream? Maybe she's in the bathroom, the jewelry box. Maybe she went in there to put on the earrings. The killer hunts through the suite. He intercepts the bride coming out unsuspectingly. I envision Melanie Brandt, radiant, full of joy. He sees it, too. Was he someone she knew? Had she just left him? Did Melanie know her killer? There's a Navajo saying, even the still wind has a voice. In the quiet, confessing hotel room, I listen. Tell me, Melanie, I am here for you. I'm listening. My skin tingles with the chill of resurrecting each detail of the murder. She fights, tries to run away, the bruises and small abrasions on her arms and neck. The killer stabs her at the foot of the bed. He is horrified, yet wildly excited about what he has done. She doesn't die immediately. He has to stab her again. And once more. When he is finished, he carries her to the bed. Not drags. There is no sign of blood trailing behind. This is important. He is gentle with her. It makes me think he knows her. Maybe he once loved Melanie? He folds her arms on her waist in a restful pose. A princess sleeping. Maybe he pretends that what has taken place is only a bad dream. Nowhere in the room do I feel the clinical pattern of professionals or hired killers, or even someone who has killed before. I'm listening. A ferocious anger rises up in his blood. He realizes he will never see her again, his princess. He's so angry. He wants to lie down with her this one time, feel her. But he cannot. That would defile her. But he must have her. So he lifts her dress, uses his fist. It is all screaming at me. I'm sure there is one last thing I am not seeing. Unrevealed. What am I missing? What has everyone missed so far? I step over to the bed. I envision Melanie, her horrifying stab wounds, but her face is calm, unaccusing. He leaves her like that. He doesn't take the earrings. He doesn't take the huge diamond ring. Then it hit me with the power of a train exploding from a dark tunnel. What was missing? What I hadn't seen. Jesus Christ, Lindsay! Rings! I ran my mind over the image of her lying there, her delicate blood-smeared hands. The diamond was still there, but... Jesus! Is it possible? I ran back to the foyer and brought to mind the crumpled body of the groom. They had been married just a few hours before. They had just completed their vows. But they weren't wearing gold bands. Wedding rings. The killer doesn't take the earrings, I realized. He takes the rings. Chapter 20. 9 the next morning, I was in the office of Dr. Victor Medved, a pleasant, smallish man with a narrow, chiseled face, who, with a trace of an Eastern European accent, scared the hell out of me.
Neglis is a killer, he stated evenly. It robs the body of its ability to transport oxygen. In the beginning, the symptoms are listlessness, a weakening of the immune system, and some lightheadedness. Ultimately, you may experience similar brain dysfunction to a stroke, and begin to lose mental capacity as well.
He got up, walked over to me, cradled my face in his gentle hands. He stared at me through thick glasses.
"You're already peaked," he said, pressing my cheeks with his thumbs.
"Always takes me a while for the blood to get hopping in the mornings," I said with a smile, trying to mask the fear in my heart.
"Well, in 3 months," Dr. Medved said, "unless we reverse it, you will look like a ghost. A pretty ghost, but a ghost all the same."
He went back to his desk and picked up my chart.
"I see you are a police detective."
"Homicide," I told him.
"Then there should be no reason to go forward under any delusions. I don't mean to upset you. Aplastic anemia can be reversed. Up to 30% of patients respond to a regimen of biweekly transfusions of packed red blood cells. Of those who do not respond, a similar percentage can be ultimately treated through a bone marrow transfer. But this involves a painful process of chemotherapy first in order to boost up the white cells."
I stiffened. Orenthaler's nightmarish predictions were coming true. "Is there any way to know who responds to the treatment?"
Medved clasped his palms together and shook his head. "The only way is to begin. Then we see."
"I'm on an important case. Dr. Orenthaler said I could continue to work."
Medved pursed his lips skeptically. "You may continue as long as you feel the strength."
I meted out a slow, painful breath. How long could I hide this? Who could I tell? "If it works, how long before we see improvement?" I asked with some hope. He frowned.
"This is not like popping aspirin for a headache. I'm afraid we're in this for the long haul."
The long haul. I thought of Roth's likely response. My chances at lieutenant. "This is it, Lindsay. This is the greatest challenge of your life." "And if it doesn't work, how long before things start to..."
"Start to get worse? Let us attack this with optimism and hope. We'll discuss that as we go along."
Everything was thrown open now. The case, my career, all the goals of my life. The stakes had changed. I was walking around with a time bomb ticking in my chest, tightly wound, incendiary, and the slow disappearing fuse was all that I thought I might be. I asked quietly, "When do we start?" He scribbled out the location of an office in the same building. "Third floor, Moffat Outpatient Services." There was no date.
"If it's all the same to you, I'd like to start right now."
Chapter 21. The story about Gerald Brandt's business deal with the Russians had broken. It was on every newsstand, bold headline, reading, "Groom's father may have triggered Russian wrath." The Chronicle reported that the FBI was seriously looking into the matter.
Great!
2 half-liter bags of hemoglobin-enriched blood were pumping through me as I finally reached my desk about 10:30. It took everything I had to push from my mind the image of the thick crimson blood slowly dripping into my vein. Roth called my name. The usual disgruntled glower was all over his face.
"Chronicle says it's the Russians. The FBI seems to agree," he said as he leaned over my desk.
He pushed a copy of the morning's paper at me. I saw it. "Don't let the FBI in on this," I said. "This is our case." I told him about last night, my going back to the crime scene, how I was pretty sure the sexual assault on the corpse, the bloody jacket, the missing rings, added up to a single obsessed killer. "It's not some Russian professional. He put his fist inside her," I reminded him. "He did this on her wedding night."
"You want me to tell the feds to back off?" Roth said, "because you have strong feelings about the case?"
"This is a murder case. A kinky, very nasty sex crime, not some international conspiracy."
"Maybe the Russian killer needed proof. Or maybe he was a sex maniac."
"Proof of what? Every paper and TV station in the country carried the story. Anyway, don't the Ruski hitters usually cut off a finger, too?" Roth rattled a frustrated sigh. His face showed more than its usual tick of agitation.
"I've got to run," I said. I shot my fist in the air and hoped that Roth got the joke.
Gerald Brandt was still at the Hyatt, waiting for his son's body to be released. I went to his suite and found him there, alone.
"You see the papers?"
I asked him as we sat at the umbrellaed table on the terrace.
"The papers. Bloomberg. Some woman reporter from the Chronicle calling all night. What they're suggesting is total madness," he said.
"Your son's death was an act of madness, Mr. Brandt. You want me to be straight with you when it comes to the investigation?"
"What do you mean, detective?"
"You were asked the other day if you knew anyone who might want to cause you harm."
"And I told you, detective, not in this way."
"You don't think certain factions in Russia might be a little angry at you for pulling out of their deal?"
"We don't deal with factions, Miss Boxer. Collier's shareholders include some of the most powerful men in this country. Anyway, you make me seem like I'm a suspect. It was business, negotiations. In what we do, we deal with this sort of thing every week. David's death has nothing to do with Collier."
"Mr. Brandt, how can you be so sure? Your son and his wife are dead."
"Because negotiations never broke off, detective. That was a ruse we used for the media. We closed on the deal last night."
He stood up, and I knew my interview was over.
My next call was to Claire. I ached to talk to her anyway. I craved my daily Claire fix. I also needed help on the case.
Her secretary said she was in the middle of a conference call when my call came in. She told me to hold on.
"Forensic specialists," Claire grumbled as she came on the line. "Listen to this. Some guy's driving 60 in a 35 zone, rams into an elderly man in his Lexus, double parked, waiting for his wife. DOA. Now the driver's tying up the guy's estate with a suit that the victim was illegally parked. All each side wants is to grab a piece of the estate, experts included. Rigetti's pushing me in because the case is being written up in an AAFS journal. Some of these bastards, you give them a penny for their thoughts, you know what you get?"
"Change," I answered with a smile. Claire was funny.
"You've got it. I've got about 31 seconds. How you doing?" she inquired. "I love you, sweetheart. I miss you. What do you want, Lindsay?"
I hesitated, part of me wishing I could let the whole thing burst out. But all I asked was if the Brants were wearing any wedding bands when they were brought in.
"To my knowledge, no," she replied. "We inventoried earrings and a diamond as large as an eyeball, but no wedding bands. I noticed that myself. In fact, that's why I was calling you last night."
"Great minds think alike," I said.
"Busy minds, at least," she countered. "How's your grisly, god-awful case coming?"
I sighed. "I don't know. Next thing we have to do is go through 300 guests to see if any might have been carrying any special grudges. You saw how this is being played up in the press. Russian revenge. The FBI is creeping around, and Chief Mercer's barking in Roth's ear to put a real detective on it. Speaking of which, I have Jacoby out trying to trace down the jacket. Other than that, the case is moving along smoothly."
Claire laughed. "Stick with it, sweetie. If anyone can solve these murders, it's you."
"I wish it were only that," I let my voice drop.
"Is everything all right?" Claire came back. "You don't sound your usual chatty, irreverent self."
"Actually, I need to talk with you. Maybe we can get together Saturday?"
"Sure," Claire said. "Oh, damn. We've got Reggie's graduation party. Can it keep a day? I could drive in for brunch on Sunday."
"Of course it can hold," I said, swallowing my disappointment. "Sunday would be great. I'd like that." I hung up with a smile. For a moment, I actually felt better about things. Just making the date with Claire made it seem as if weights had been lifted off my shoulders. Sunday would give me some time to prepare. About how I was going to deal with the treatment and my job.
Raleigh wandered up. "You want to grab a coffee?"
I thought he was needling me about what time I'd come in. He must have sensed my resentment.
He wagged a legal-sized manila envelope in my face and shrugged. "It's the Brandt's wedding guest list. I thought you'd want to see who made the cut."
Chapter 22.
We went down to Roma's, one of those stucco-on-stucco, high-ceilinged, Euro-style coffee joints across the street from the hall. I prefer Pete's, but Roma's is closer. I ordered a tea, and Raleigh came back with some fancy mocha latte and a slice of fresh pumpkin bread that he put in front of me.
"You ever wonder how these places make any money?" he asked.
"What?"
I looked at him. "There's one on every corner. They all serve the same thing, and their average sale's gotta be, what, $2.35?
"This isn't a date, Raleigh," I snapped. "Let's go through the list."
"Maybe closer to $3 or $3.50. Lucky if the place is gross $400,000.
"Raleigh, please," I said, losing patience. He pushed the envelope toward me. I opened it and fanned out 8 or 9 pages of names and addresses bearing Gerald Brandt's office crest. I recognized some of the guests on the groom's side immediately. Bert Rosen, former Secretary of the Treasury of the United States. Sumner Smith, some billionaire who had made his money in the 80s through big-time LBOs. Chip Stein of E-Flix, Spielberg's buddy. Maggie Santero, the hot Soho designer from New York. Lots of big names and big trouble. From the bride's side, there were several prominent names from the San Francisco area. Mayor Fernandez, for me. Arthur Abrams, the prominent local attorney. I had gone up against his firm once or twice in the witness box, testifying in homicide cases. Willie Upton, superintendent of public schools. Raleigh pulled his seat over to me. Side by side, we scanned the rest of the list. Columns of impressive-sounding couples with doctor or honorable in front of their names. It was a long, unrevealing, seemingly impenetrable list. I don't know what I expected. Just something to jump out at me. Some flashing name resonating with a culpability even the families didn't recognize. Raleigh let out a worried breath.
"This list is scary. You take 50, I'll take 50, and we'll give the balance to Jacoby. We'll all meet back here in 2 weeks and see what we've got."
The prospect of hammering away at these people, each one horrified and indignant at the prospect of why we were looking into them, didn't fill me with joy or high hopes. "You think Mayor Fernandez might be a sex killer?" I muttered. "I do." What came out of me next was a complete surprise. "So, you said you were married?" If we were going to be thrown together, we might as well get it out. And the truth was, I was curious. Raleigh nodded after a short pause. I thought I saw pain in his eyes.
"Actually, I still am. Our divorce is coming up next month. 17 years.
I flashed him a sympathetic wag of my eyes. "I'm sorry."
"Let's stop the Q&A. It's okay. Things happen." Suddenly it seemed we were just traveling in different circles. To be more precise, Marion fell in love with the guy who owned the real estate office where she worked. It's an old story. I guess I never quite learned which fork to use.
"I could have saved you some pain," I said. "It goes left to right." "Are there kids?"
2 great boys, 14 and 12. Jason is the jock, Teddy's the brain. Set up a homepage for his 6th grade class. I get them every other weekend. Lights of my life, Lindsay.
I could actually see Raleigh as super dad, kicking the ball around on Saturdays, installing the computer in the den. On top of it, the guy did have affectionate eyes. It was gradually dawning on me that he wasn't the enemy.
"I guess," he grinned at me, "getting the order of forks right didn't exactly help you, though. You're divorced, right?"
"Ooh, somebody's been checking around," I said. I was just out of the police academy. Tom was in his 2nd year of law school at Berkeley. At first, he was going to go criminal. We had sort of a Carville and Madeline thing going. I imagined me testifying, Tom Terrific socking it to me on the cross. Ultimately, he opted for corporate.
"And?"
"It was his picture, not mine. I wasn't ready for the country club." "It's an old story, right?" I smiled. "The truth..." He walked out on me. Kind of broke my heart into tiny pieces.
"Sounds like we've got some things in common," Raleigh said gently.
He did have nice eyes.
"Stop it, Lindsay!"
"If you must know," I replied, deadpan, "for the past 6 months I've been having this torrid affair with Warren Jacoby."
Raleigh laughed and pretended to look surprised.
Geez, Jacoby doesn't seem like your type. What's the fatal attraction?
I thought of my ex-husband, Tom. Then one other man I had been sort of serious about. What always attracted me when I let someone get close. Soft hands. And, I guess, a soft heart.
So, what you think? Raleigh said. You put a few homemade jams on the shelves. Give the coffee some sexier names. Arabian Breeze, Sirocco. You think we can hike up the average sale?
Why are you going through this, Raleigh? He gave me a look that was sort of between an embarrassed grin and a sparkle in his clear blue eyes.
I've been doing police work for 16 years. So, you get to thinking. I have this favorite place, up in Tahoe. Maybe one of these franchises...
Sorry, I don't see you behind the counter picking out the muffins.
Nicest thing you've said to me so far.
I got up, tucked the envelope under my arm, and headed toward the door. On second thought, you might make a better baker than a cop.
That's my girl, he smiled. Wise guy answer for everything. Keep those defenses up.
As we left the shop, I softened and said to him, I have this favorite place, too.
Maybe you'll show me one day.
Maybe I will. I was surprised by Raleigh. Live and learn. He was actually a nice guy. I wondered if he had soft hands.
Chapter 23. When Rebecca Passanot looked at herself in the full splendor of her wedding dress, she knew that she was no longer her mother's little girl.
You're my baby.
She had heard those words from her very first days on the planet. With three older brothers, it wasn't so hard to imagine why. Her mother had always wanted a girl. Daddy, too. But as the years went on, they had assumed their time had passed. The oldest, Ben, the daredevil, had been killed before she was born. Her parents were crushed. They couldn't even think of more children. Then, miraculously, Becky came.
My baby!
She heard her mother exclaim from where she stood behind Becky.
Oh, Mom!
Becky sighed, but she also smiled. She continued to look at herself. She was beautiful. In her long, white, strapless dress, an avalanche of tulle, she shone like the most lovely and beautiful thing in the world. Michael would be so happy. With all the arrangements, the hotel in Napa, the flowers, the last-minute alterations to the dress, she had never thought the day would actually come. But now it was almost here. Friday. Miss Perkins, the saleswoman at Saks, could only stand and admire.
You're gonna knock 'em dead, sweetheart.
Becky spun around, catching herself in every view of the three-paneled mirror. She grinned.
I will, won't I? Your father and I want you to have something, her mother said.
She reached into her purse and pulled out a small suede jewelry pouch. In it was her diamond brooch. A 4-carat oval on a string of pearls, passed on from her own mother. She stepped closer to Becky, clasped the strand around her neck.
It's gorgeous, Becky gasped. Oh, Mom! It was given to me on my wedding day, her mother said. It has brought me a beautiful life. Now, it's for you.
Becky Passanot stood there in the spell of the mirror. The glorious dress, the diamond in the hollow of her throat. She finally stepped off the alteration platform and hugged her mother.
I love you, Mom. You're the best. Now, it's complete, her mother said with a tear in her eye.
No, not quite, said Miss Perkins. She ran into the back and hurriedly returned with a bouquet of flowers.
Imitations, sales accessories, but at the moment they looked like the most resplendent blossoms in the world. She gave them to Becky, who stepped back up onto the platform, hugging them to herself. She saw her beaming smile reflected 3 times. They all stood back and admired.
Now you are complete, Miss Perkins said.
Standing nearby in Saks, watching Becky model her stunning dress, Philip Campbell couldn't have agreed more.
Your big day is almost here,
he whispered softly.
You look beautiful.
Chapter 24. The following morning, Milt Fanning from the FBI Sex Crimes Unit reported in. His computer had popped up a handful of related crimes.
but he was letting me know that none of them was a strong lead. They had started by plugging in fists used in the act of sexual assault, and that produced several cases, mostly gay crimes. One was in connection with a couple of murdered prostitutes in Compton that dated back to 1992, but Nicholas Cheeto was serving 25 years to life in San Quentin for that. There had been several hotel murders, even one involving newlyweds in Ohio, in which the groom had opened up the womb of his beloved with a 30-30 when he discovered he wasn't the first. But there was nothing local or still outstanding, nothing tangible to give us a direction. I was disappointed, but not surprised. Everything we had uncovered so far convinced me that when David and Melanie Brand ran into their killer at the Hyatt, it wasn't the first time they had met. I saw Jacoby wandering in from outside. For 2 days he had been avoiding me, running down his assignments, specifically the searches for the champagne and the jacket. After 2 years I knew that when Jacoby wasn't needling me, he wasn't happy. "How's the search going?" I asked. He flashed me a tight-lipped smirk.
"Chin and Murphy are calling every frickin' wine store in a 40-mile radius. You think any of these guys keep track of this sort of thing? They all tell me that bottle could have been ordered from anywhere in the country. Then there's mail order to consider. The Internet. Cripes!"
I knew it was a long shot, but how many people pay $200 for a bottle of champagne?
"Still," he finally faced me with a self-satisfied smile, "we came up with some names."
As if to torture me, Jacoby leafed through his notepad to what must have been page 30. Then he squinted, cleared his throat, saying,
"Yeah, here we go. Golden State Wine Shop on Crescent. Krug, Clos du Mesnil," he pronounced, bludgeoning the French. "1989. Someone ordered a case of the stuff last March, name of Roy C. Schoen."
"You checked him out?" He nodded.
"Never heard of any Brandt. He's a dentist. I guess rich dentists like fancy wine, too."
He flipped over the page.
"Then there's Vineyard Wines in Mill Valley. Murphy handled it."
For the first time in a couple of days, he really smiled at me.
"The guy who bought the wine was named Murphy, too. Regular customer there. Threw a dinner party for his wife's birthday. You want to give me a morning off, I'll check him out, but I thought I'd send Murphy himself, just for the laugh."
"Any luck with the tuxedo jacket?"
"We called the manufacturer. 15 stores in the area sell this brand. If it even came from around here. We're bringing in their local rep, tracking down the owner of this thing. It ain't gonna be easy."
"While you're out there, Warren," I teased, "see if you can pick yourself up a decent tie."
"Ho, ho. So, how you getting along without me?"
Jacoby asked, facing me. He flattened his lips, and I could see the disappointment all over his face. Made me feel bad. "I'm coping." Then, seriously, "I'm sorry, Warren. You know that I didn't ask for this guy." He nodded self-consciously.
"You want me to check out everyone we dig up who's into fancy champagne?"
I shook my head. I got up, dropped a copy of the Brandt wedding list on his desk. "What I want you to do is check and see if they match against this list." He leafed through the lists, whistling at a few of the more prominent names.
"Too bad, Boxer. No Schoen or Murphy. Maybe we'll just have to wait and take a shot at couple number two."
"What makes you say that?" I asked. Jacoby was a pain in the ass, but he was a good cop, with a good nose for sniffing out a pattern.
"We're looking for a spiffy dresser who likes to get dirty with dead brides, right?"
I nodded. I remembered something my first partner had told me. "Never wrestle with a pig, Lindsay. You both get dirty. The pig likes it."
"I figure it's gotta be hard for a guy like that to find a date," said Jacoby.
Chapter 25. The first week of the bride and groom investigation was gone. Unbelievable. Jacoby's team had pounded the jacket and champagne search, but so far they had come up empty. Raleigh and I had spoken to 20 wedding guests, from the mayor to the groom's best friend. All of them were numb and sickened, but unable to put a finger on any one thing that might move us along. All I could focus on was that we needed something firm, fast, before this guy who took the rings killed again. I underwent my second transfusion. I watched the thick red blood drip into my veins. I prayed it was making me stronger, but I didn't know. It had the slow, steady beat of a ticking clock. And the clock was ticking. Mine, Chief Mercer's. Saturday at 6